Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is knowledge and product editor Sarah Davidson. And this week, the focus is on investing. We travel across the pond, investigate rich and responsible returns, and we try to keep calm and carry on. Plus, we take a look at This Is Money's comprehensive Green Money Guide. Don't forget to update with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, as the US election enters its final turbulent weeks, how will the result on the 3rd of November affect investors? Will it be Trump? Will it be Biden? Will it be Biden, but Trump takes his ball and storms off back to the White House saying he rejects any outcome in which he doesn't win? The outcome was never going to be pretty. The run-up hasn't been that attractive either. Throw COVID into the mix and who knows what will happen. So what should investors do now? Simon, firstly, your take on the whole situation. I'm going to say politically speaking first, and then we'll get into the sort of money and investing. You know, keep us up to date with what's been happening.
I wouldn't even begin to imagine that I could keep you up to date with what's been happening in US politics.
I mean, as best you can.
If there's anything that makes ours look relatively sane, it's taking a good, long, hard look over the pond at the US. Suffice it to say, Donald Trump is behind in the polls and Joe Biden is ahead. Donald Trump is the continuity candidate. However, with Donald Trump, the word continuity needs to be taken in Trumpian context because he is a man who provides quite a lot of volatility and not a lot of continuity. Joe Biden, Donald Trump's opponent, who also likes to shout at people on the television, as we saw when the two of them had a rather not great looking face off the other week, is seen as the sort of more stable back to normal candidate, but it has some socialist leanings, may raise taxes, may be more crackdown on business kind of stuff. Looking at this from an economic and financial and corporate perspective, whereas Donald Trump has handed a load of tax breaks, largely to more wealthy people, but the idea is that trickles down. And a lot of companies have taken the tax breaks and given lots of money to their shareholders, and the stock market's gone up lots and various other things. But Trump is behind and Biden is ahead. At the moment, it sort of looks like the stock market and the markets are happy with that. Now, that's being read as they're happy with it, even though they think Biden might be a bit worse for wealth creation and business and that sort of thing, because Biden will be a return to a more normal form of politics than the slightly chaotic last 4 years that we've seen under Trump, a man who conducts his own personal vendettas on Twitter, which, depending on your worldview, is either a very bad look for the president of the United States or exactly the kind of thing that he should be doing. The thing is, though, perhaps the markets aren't really looking at Biden as being that more stable. What they're actually looking at is whatever happens, the Federal Reserve is going to keep printing money and there's going to be a massive stimulus package. And that's just going to keep inflating things and keep things trucking along in the same direction. Someone I know who works in the investing world, when a friend had said, it looks like markets are favoring Trump, he said, well, actually, I think markets are favoring Biden at the moment. But to be honest, you could have the apocalypse happen, and as long as the Fed continued printing, nobody would care. So there's a lot of very difficult things to unpick there. What should be said, though, is that it's interesting because only a few months ago, the suggestion was that markets would prefer Trump as the continuity candidate, even with his erratic behavior, because they just get more of the same that they've had over the last 4 years. And until the coronavirus crash, that was very good for markets. And then things have rebounded extremely, extremely strongly since. But also, the polls could be wrong and Trump could just win anyway. There's lots of people saying there's no way he could possibly win now. But they said there was no way he could possibly win last time around, and he did. So to give the sort of classic piece of commentators get out, when they have the sense to say that they don't know what's going to happen, I don't know what's going to happen. And it's very difficult to make hide nor hair of. But that makes it, to go back to what we were talking about in the first place, all the more important to think about this a little bit as an investor, because things could go in any number of directions. And that's not even taking into account the other really big issues going on in the world at the moment.
Yeah, there's a few, aren't there? Sarah, is the reality then at this stage, it's the markets probably just want this resolved quickly?
I don't know. I feel like markets have had such a kind of tumultuous 12 months that, as Simon's investment friend says, pretty much nothing really rocks them now. The reaction to the enormous spending package that Rishi Sunak announced late summer just barely even registered in the stock market. And I think it does come down to that whenever I speak to people in the industry. I was speaking to someone who runs one of the larger challenger banks, and he said, it doesn't matter what happens because the Bank of England is just going to underwrite it. So I think the same thing applies to all of this. I think there are other things that are more likely to affect the stock market's performance. Like, for example, and this is probably relevant to the presidential election, how the big tech companies are regulated in future. That's probably more of a risk. And I don't know actually what the position of either candidate is on that. But given that the US stock market is so dominated by those big tech companies, I would think that that's sort of probably more relevant.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting how we anthropomorphize the markets. What does the market think? Well, but what should investors think? Simon?
And that's a very important point, because do you know what? We shouldn't really care what the market thinks. We shouldn't make decisions based on what the market thinks. This is one of the great problems post financial crisis. It was like, well, what will the markets think? What will the markets think? If we don't get a handle on our debt, if we don't have austerity, what will the markets think? It's like, well, the markets are just a weighing machine for, you know, what something is worth. And the markets may think, well, they also resemble a bunch of children playing football, where they all run in one direction after the ball, and then they all run in the other direction after the ball, and then they all run in the other direction after the ball. You know, there's all kinds of behavioral issues with the markets that we have identified in many, many different ways. And the graph of a stock market or a bond price or anything else will tell you everything you need to know about herd mentality. So we should worry more about what's actually the right thing to do or what's the right choice. And the people in America are being presented with that very choice right now. And they shouldn't be basing it on what they think markets will do. But as investors, obviously, we need to pay attention to that. It's like, what could the reaction be? Now, arguably, I would say that the reaction to either a Biden or a Trump win, decisive win, is probably going to be just that we continue reasonably along the same track. Does one mean more stimulus than the other? Does one favour business more than the other? Not so much. The problem will be if there is not a decisive victory. The problem will be is if this descends into a legal argument, a political argument, well, you haven't won. I have won. No, you haven't won scenario. That's where the problems will lie and things will suddenly get shaken up. And I think then, to go back to what Sarah said, if all of a sudden one of those candidates who does win comes out and says, do you know what, actually, we're going to totally stop this whole policy of, you know, massive Fed stimulus. Actually, I am going to completely break up big tech and come down really, really hard on them. And people genuinely believed that those two things would be followed through on, because it's one thing saying them, it's another thing actually doing them. That's the kind of thing that would upset the apple cart, I think.
You've been speaking to experts about the advice that they would give to investors considering investing in the US. What's been some of the stuff that they've been telling you?
Okay, so from Adrian Locock at Willisone, he said, it doesn't make much sense for investors to try and predict who will be in the White House in 2021, as general elections are notoriously difficult to predict. Just think back to Trump's victory in 2016. It's such a binary result that if you get the outcome wrong, it could have a significant detrimental impact on your investments. Of course, even getting the result right might not lead to markets behaving the way that you would expect. And that's a very, very important point. Neil Wilson at markets.com says the only thing the market wants is to get the election out of the way. And the only real danger would be a long period of legal disputes post-election, as I just said. if you look at the S&P 500, the main US stock market, it's dominated by very large tech companies. Adrian Locock says this is the thing that the US markets look expensive, but that's because a few very large companies' share prices dominate it. They are trading at high levels. But there are arguments put forward by people that some of those companies are not that expensive. I spoke to Stephen Yu of the Blue Whale Global Growth Fund the other week, and he put forward the case that he doesn't think Facebook, for example, actually is particularly expensive. He said that it's got a lot of cash, and then if you were to break up the business, so say an antitrust situation, what they call in the US, the equivalent of our competition and markets kind of scenario. In an antitrust situation, Facebook is forced to be broken up. Not only is Facebook sitting on lots of cash, but secondly, it's got a number of very valuable businesses there. It's got Facebook, it's got Instagram, it's got WhatsApp, okay? Any one of those would be a highly successful and highly valuable business on its own. And arguably only two of those are being monetized, Facebook and Instagram. WhatsApp is not really being monetized particularly well. If they decided to split out WhatsApp, keep Facebook and Instagram together properly and get properly monetized WhatsApp, you might find that actually Facebook shares are worth more. So you could find a scenario where breaking up some of these companies actually means that they're worth more. Amazon, for example, you know, world's biggest online retailer, huge, you know, absolutely dominant. Jeff Bezos has been making 40 million squillion pounds every second of the day that we've been in lockdown, etc. Also has an extremely successful cloud computing. Amazon Web Services basically powers half the internet now. Were you to split those two companies up, perhaps you might end up with something that is greater than the, you know, the sum of their parts. So Jason Hollins said that there is growing scrutiny of these tech giants. There's been a number of reports that don't mince their words. It depends what sort of influence you get amongst the Democrats. Parts of the Democrats look very much like the Tories in this country. Other parts of them look a little bit more like Jeremy Corbyn's Labour. How much does that have to sway? I think as investors, what you need to be doing is looking at most investors in the US who are in the UK can be investing in funds, they can be investing in investment trusts, they might be investing in ETFs. And you might have, if it's an ETF or a tracker just following the market, you're just following the market. Keep on trucking. Maybe think about, have you allocated too much to the US? Have you allocated not enough? Because the US makes up about 60% of the global stock market. And if you're under that, you're underweight the US. If you've got a fund or a trust, look at what that fund or trust holds. What's it actually doing? Is it doing what it's meant to be doing? And is it exploiting the opportunities of the future or just capitalizing on the stuff that went up in the past? And one of the things that has been flagged as being potentially interesting by Adrian Locock and by some of the others who we featured in this article is US smaller companies. Now, US smaller companies are absolutely huge companies. If you planted them into the UK, funnily enough, they're not actually that small. But in that part of the market, they're not quite so well researched. The valuations aren't quite so high, and there might be some opportunities there. And also the thing that's done very, very well recently is growth shares, growth companies, companies that promise lots and lots of growth in the future. Value, companies that have had their share price beaten down, their prospects don't look so good, but maybe they're a bit of a bargain. They've not done so well. It might be time to look at value, but people have been saying that every single year since just after the financial crisis, and every single year growth's been outstripping it. So don't bet the house on that either.
Yeah, right now I wouldn't bet the house on much. But all right, in sum, Simon, Trump or Biden, or neither? Or a big long wrangle.
You're asking me to choose?
Yeah, go on.
Oh,
better than investigating whether the interest rates will go up and down for regular podcast listeners. That used to be our favourite game. Bored of that now.
I'm notoriously non-partisan. Do you know what? I tell you what the answer to that is I cannot believe that they had 4 years to come up with a better candidate to run against Donald Trump and they came up with Joe Biden. That's what I really think, and that's what an awful lot of people think. I'm like, how did you manage to do this? You came up with basically the choice between Bernie and Biden. Like, what happened to all the other people? But yeah, I just, in all honesty, I don't really think the world needs another 4 years of Donald Trump as president.
Yeah.
It's a fun ride, but I'm not sure we need another 4 years of it.
I don't know about you, Sarah, but I know that the government's come under quite a bit of criticism of late. And Simon, that was a brilliant politician's answer there. So if you know, this is money isn't working out in a while, perhaps run for PM. Thanks, PM. Sarah?
I gave you the real answer in the end.
Oh, look at that half. Oh, no, Simon. I mean, what do you reckon?
I'm totally with Simon on that. It's like a bad choice or a worse bad choice.
Yep. Should we go for the devil or the deep blue sea?
Would you like to be shot in the hand or the foot?
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh, depends which hand, to be honest. All right, well, I'll move on from that. Very good. But no, it's a fair point. What we've been talking about this year is may have left us feeling, shall we say, a little bit jittery about our investments? Well, about life generally, but we'll stick with investing. Financial markets, been on something of a roller coaster ride. To the value of the UK's biggest 100 companies, fallen by a fifth. Sectors such as leisure, tourism, some retail on their absolute knees at the moment, and the ride is not done. I mean, we've spoken about the US election, then we've obviously more COVID restrictions, doubtless on the horizon, and Brexit, anyone? But where there is difficulty, there could also be opportunity. And let's be honest, it's not like cash savings are a particularly attractive alternative right now. So where are the opportunities to be found, and how can you keep calm and carry on amidst all this madness, Sarah? You can understand a few nerves right now, though.
I mean, yeah. My sense is that the rules of investing don't change, regardless of what the markets are doing. You know, there are some really basic tenets that it's good to stick to, which is don't panic when things are bad or look bad, and also don't jump on the next bubble bandwagon. If your taxi driver is telling you to invest in Bitcoin, the time is past. And also invest little and often if you can afford to do that, because then that, you know, helps you to ride out those peaks and troughs. I also feel like markets are just not behaving in the way that they would in a normal circumstances. We've had an apocalypse. I mean, this is exactly, we're in that state, and people are just so overwhelmed by all this risk that it's like water off a duck's back now, personally. And I think that is down to the Bank of England in the UK and the Fed in the US just saying, look, it doesn't matter. Whatever happens, we'll just print more money. I mean, that's what they're doing. It requires a bit of a willing suspension of disbelief, though, because I'm just like...
That's just life right now, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So in that case, though, that's how to keep calm. But how do you carry on to some advantage? I mean, let's be honest, COVID is not a winning thing. But there are opportunities, on the not, Simon, to be found here?
Yeah, certainly there are. And I think you have to make a decision to say, look, I'm going to... What am I doing here? Am I just trying to trade for short-term gains? Am I investing long-term? Or am I going to do something in the middle? And it's actually probably the something in the middle bit that you need to worry about more than either end. Because if you say, well, I'm just trading for short-term gains, then what you need to accept is that you're not buying that company or that share. You're not buying that company's shares. You're not buying that investment trust. You're not buying that fund. You're not buying that ETF because you think it's going to be worth more money in 5 years' time. You're buying it to get some form of gain over the short term and then get out after you've made that gain. That comes with the potential that you're also going to make some losses over the short term, but you're working on the basis that you'll get more right than you'll get wrong. And so as long as you accept that that is what you're doing, and that is what a lot of this new breed of share investors have been doing post-lockdown, then that's fine. You're trading, you're not investing. If you are investing, then you need to be thinking long-term. What's long-term? Long-term's 5 years at least. And so you need to be looking at what you're buying and going, what is the underlying case for investing in this? Why do I think that this is going to be a good thing? Does it suit me and fit me? And also, not am I getting in at the absolute best price ever and I'm going to get in here, you know, yeah, it's at, you know, that kind of thing. But is it at a good price, you know? And when you talk to a lot of fund managers, successful fund managers, they will say to you, don't try and time the market. The first thing is just don't try and time the market. Second thing, the first rule of investing is don't try and time the market. Second rule of investing is don't try and time the market, kind of thing. But they will also say to you that, of course, they pay attention to the price that they get into an investment at. do they think that they are buying in at a time when it is cheap, reasonably valued in terms of what it offers in the future, or expensive? And if it's the answer's expensive, then you need to really think about whether you should invest. So if you're looking to exploit the opportunities, then that's what you need to be doing. You need to be looking at, is there this thing that I think is right for me and that I would invest in? So under normal circumstances, not just because it's gone down in price or just because it's gone up in price lots, which is what lots of people do, but is it this thing that is right for me to invest in? And then is this a good time to buy it in terms of the price? Not I'm getting that absolute, you know, getting it at the lowest price, going to make a quick buck, this is going to be great. Not time in the market kind of thing, but like, what's it like, you know? Because think about it in the same way that you buy anything else in life. If you were going to buy a sofa, you'd be like, do I like this sofa? Is it the right sofa for my house? You know, am I going to continue to like this sofa in 3 years' time? You know, because I'm not planning on changing my sofa every 6 months. And finally, once I've made that decision, is this sofa fairly priced? Because if it's a great sofa and it's exactly the kind of thing that you'd like to sit on and it would suit your house very well, you might be willing to pay a little bit more for it, but you wouldn't be willing to pay like three times more than it was worth. So you need to kind of think about those things. Mm. And then there's sort of there's just things like just continuing to regularly invest, just keep those regular investments going in. Also not selling out if such things suddenly fall, don't just panic and sell out. People could have lost an awful lot of money if they'd have suddenly panicked at the end of March and ditched a load of their investments. Likewise, people could lose a lot of money if they look at things that have gone up tons and tons and tons and go, I want to jump on that train, and jump in when stuff is really expensive. And I think it's just a case of having your wits about you and using some common sense and then thinking that, you know, just because it doesn't go right immediately, just because in 6 months or a year's time it hasn't gone right, that doesn't mean that it won't come right in the end if your case for doing all these things still stacks up. But I do think there is also an argument for not just blindly sticking by something. Sometimes you do need to look at things and go, actually, this was just a mistake and maybe it's time to cut my losses.
Sound advice there, Simon, sound advice. You have made me think about, though, what is a fair price for a sofa? Because I'm in the market at the moment. Three-seater sofa? What do you reckon?
It depends who you are, doesn't it? It depends on the quality of the sofa. I think a fair price for a three-seater sofa is somewhere between £500 and £1,000, is it?
Fair enough.
£500 and £1,500. Depends how long it's going to last you, doesn't it? And how much money you've got, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's a fair point.
So, I mean, how long did you own your last sofa for?
I love my sofa. Yeah, I've only had it for a couple of years.
Okay.
It's not the most comfy, but I love it nonetheless because I bought it and it was a big purchase. And I will like a big purchase, for goodness sake. But it serves me. I sit on it and it looks okay.
Yeah. So I reckon we owned the sofa that we got before now. I reckon we've had the sofa we've had now for about 2 or 3 years, right?
Yeah.
I reckon the sofa that we owned before that, we owned for 10 years, maybe. When you think about that and you think, well, am I likely to suddenly change my whole attitude to life and become a person who changes their sofa every 2 years? No, highly unlikely. I'm exactly the kind of person who keeps the same sofa for 5 to 10 years. Then maybe you can go, well, actually, I could afford to spend a bit more on the sofa because actually that sofa is going to last me a very long time. I tell you what we did do, make a major false economy, and this is going off a massive tangent.
That's fine. I took it massive there. So tangent, that's all right.
Bear we had the sofa.
And Sarah.
And we wanted to get a chair that went with it. And we needed it to fit in a specific kind of space. So it needed to be smaller. But we wanted something bigger than an armchair, smaller than a sofa. What's one of those called?
Can you remember?
Oh, love seat, yeah.
Or they call them a snuggler.
Snuggler?
Snuggler, right?
Either way, it sounds nice.
Anyway, so we bought our sofa from John Lewis, okay? It wasn't an expensive John Lewis sofa. It wasn't the super cheap John Lewis sofa. It was a nice sofa. It came in a specific colour, and they had this seat that matched it. But we didn't buy that seat at the time. And then it came down in price, and we were like, oh, we should go buy it now. Mm. We didn't buy it. We thought, oh, we should have done it. And then it went out of stock in the same material. And the same color, and we thought, oh no, we've missed the boat. And then it came back into stock, right? Guess which idiots didn't go out and buy that seat straight away? This bunch of idiots. And then it went out and it's never come back in, and you can't get that material and you can't get that color anymore.
To reel this back.
There's a lesson in life.
There's a lesson for investing.
There's a lesson in life there that applies to many, many different things.
There you go.
In different aspects of life, in your consumer behavior, in your investing, in buying houses, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, if that thing really matters to you and it would really, really fit you and suit you, then maybe you should just do it.
Yeah. Dear listener. Thank you.
Because otherwise it'd be gone.
Off on a mad tangent then, but actually there was a moral to that story. Yeah. It's all pre-planned randomness. Anyway, I am going to bring it back to subject because we are focusing on going green. Because I don't know about you, but I feel that there's a lot more focus on ethical investing as a result of coronavirus pandemic. Perhaps not, but I've noticed it. In his speech to the Tory Party conference, the Prime Minister announced a $160 million investment to increase capacity in offshore wind. Add that to the existing commitment to reduce the UK's carbon footprint to net zero by 2050. And whether you agree with climate change or not, it probably makes sense to have ethical investing on your radar. But where should you be looking? Firstly, Sarah, a bit more about the government's kind of plans and why this feeds into investing in ethical.
Yeah, so basically, under Theresa May's time in office, the UK was the first country, I think still maybe the only country in the world, to put into law the fact that we would meet a net zero carbon emissions target by a certain date, that date being 2050. And that's not going to be easy to do. That's a big job. But as you were saying earlier, you know, where there are challenges, there are also opportunities. And it is a huge job. Like, for example, most of the housing stock in the UK has a gas boiler for it to run its heating systems. If we want to reduce our carbon footprint, we're going to have to replace all gas boilers with electric heat pumps. Probably, although there is also an argument for biomass as well, but there's different types of technology. That is going to cost money, but that also powers the economy. And the government has entirely recognised the economic potential of this net zero target, and is now putting money behind that. They've branded the economic recovery that we need to see happen, the green recovery, so that all of the kind of public sector spending will be viewed through that lens. So does this project, infrastructure project, help us to contribute to net zero, help us to achieve net zero? And that offers lots and lots of opportunities for private investors as well, because there are certain key areas which we know are going to have lots of government money put into them, so the value of them should rise.
I should have asked you before as well, but I'll ask you now, what exactly is ethical investing? Because it's not all about climate change, is it?
No, ethical investing, it's very difficult. There's not actually one definition. You've got sustainable, you've got positive impact, social impact. Ethical basically broadly means not investing in companies you don't feel good about, mm-hmm. or that are doing things that are, you know, contrary to better, cleaner living, like tobacco, arms dealing. There's an argument at the moment about whether or not big energy, oil and gas companies fall into ethical or not ethical, because BP, for example, is still actively drilling for oil and gas, but it also is a huge investor in renewables. So it's like good and bad, depending on how you decide you want to define that. It's one of the biggest challenges actually in this area is it's so difficult to know what the person selling you the thing they want you to buy means by what they're saying on their marketing spiel.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. But I guess also the fact, I mean, it's why it's so difficult to define is because, well, it's based on our values. I don't mean value as in cheap. I mean values of our morals, our ethics, and everybody's is different, I guess. But so Sarah sort of laid out there that the government's increasing investment in this area, and I guess a lot of companies as well. Once they get a taste or an idea that people are actually more interested, we've got the Greta effect. They're inevitably going to shift towards that. Is that fair?
Yes. You've seen this with ESG at the moment, which is the buzzword in the investing world. And as with any buzzword, I'd take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, to be perfectly honest. How much of this ESG label is just being slapped on stuff because that's what fund managers think people want, especially institutional investors. You know, institutional investors, big pension funds, etc., like that, they've got pressure from their trustees. They feel the need to look good. You've got big corporates, they feel the need to look good. So like, oh yeah, we're only gonna back ESG stuff, we're only gonna back ESG stuff. But how much attention are they actually paying to the ESG stuff that's going on there? How much of an actual filter is taking place for ESG? Is it just three words being slapped on a fund? Or is the investor actually actively doing that? And I would question how many of these funds and the investors are actively doing that. And it's the whole greenwash problem again. And I think that with anything like that, it becomes a bit of a bandwagon, becomes a bit of a gravy train. And it sort of filters out the goodness of it. Arguably, you should be paying attention to ESG anyway, because you'd have to be an absolute lunatic in the current world to deliberately invest in a company that was either bad for the environment, bad for society, or actively had bad corporate governance. I mean, that's just like part of being an investor, is you try to choose the best companies and you avoid the risks. And the risks in this world certainly include being pulled up for being really bad for the environment, really bad for society, or having terrible corporate governance. So you should be doing that anyway. Where I think it is interesting is where you have investors who are actively getting involved in trying to work with the companies that they invest in to improve some of these things. Because if you can suddenly start climbing that ladder, as Sarah said, you'll have a tailwind behind you, and also you'll be doing better things for the world. This ranges from the Mobius Emerging Markets Investment Trust that was launched a couple of years back. Mark Mobius, very famous emerging markets manager, works with a guy called Carlos Hardenberg, who he worked with at Templeton. And part of their ESG overlay involves actually getting involved with companies and trying to improve their corporate governance, trying to make those companies work better. And one of the concerns about some emerging market companies has always been corporate governance. Or there are funds and trusts that, you know, go out and back stuff that is either good for the environment or helping to deal with environmental challenges. I invest in an investment trust myself called Impacts Environmental Markets, and that actively looks for companies that are doing things to help with the environmental problems that we face, or doing things to help with deal with the environmental problems that we face. And this could range from companies that, for example, make reverse vending machines. So a reverse vending machine, you put your plastic in and then you get some money or a token out. And these are great ideas for supermarkets and things like that. It encourages people to recycle because you put your recycling in and you get something back for it. Or it could be companies that are involved in helping to improve farming with digital methods. So farming is still very much a analog endeavor. You know, the farmer goes outside, licks his finger, sticks it in the air. Yeah, I reckon that. It's far more based on experience and everything. This is not to talk down farmers. I've got plenty of farmers in family who would take me to task on that one. But it is like one of those areas where you haven't really seen much of the help that digitalization can bring. But there are companies now that are going out there saying to farmers, look, we can put these sensors in the ground. You can see exactly when crops need more water, exactly when they don't need so much water, when they're doing well, when they're not doing well. and it can improve the yield of farming whilst lowering the use of pesticides and things that are bad for the environment, using less water, and the world has a huge problem with water use, and all other kinds of things that can dramatically reduce the environmental impact and the carbon footprint of farming. Also, there's a company that makes an alternative to cotton. Cotton, I always thought cotton was good. Buy cotton. It's good. It's natural, isn't it? It's great. Environmental disaster.
Watch the movie cotton. True Cost.
Yeah, absolute environmental disaster. So if you can get an alternative to it, that's absolutely great. You can invest in companies that, you can invest in funds that just target trying to improve food production. You can invest in companies that target trying to improve water production. You can invest in company in this effectively investment trusts that are just invested in renewable energy, in wind power, for example, all these kinds of things. And if you think, actually, these things are important to me and I think that we need to look after the world that we live in, and you don't need to buy the argument, you don't need to buy into climate change or not, you don't have to be out there doing with the Extinction Rebellion protests, chaining yourself to a policeman or gluing yourself to a tube. In fact, I'd advise you not to do
that.
Yeah,
don't do that.
You don't have to believe it. You don't even have to believe in that to actually just think that looking after your own backyard is a good idea. So, you know, if you think that, then maybe put your money to work in it, because not only will your savings be doing something useful and something aligned in what you believe in, but you might make some money off the back of it. And let's face it, the way the wind is blowing, this is a growth industry and is going to continue to be a growth industry for decades to come. And governments do not have the money to do this stuff by themselves. They are absolutely relying on private enterprise to fix a lot of this stuff for them. So if you can tap into that, then, you know, maybe, as we say, sometime tens of years down the line, you'll sit back, you'll pat yourself on the back and say, great, not only did I make some money, I put my savings to productive use and I slightly improved the world.
Exactly. What more could you want? But it's not just investing that you can make a difference with your money. There are lots of other ways. Really, mortgages is one of them. I mean, who knew? Yeah. Savings, current accounts. This is money. I mean, you see it here, Sarah. I think you've pulled together a comprehensive green money guide so that, you know, if we do care about the environment, we do want our money to do a bit of good. What should we be doing? Where should we start?
So this is quite a new area. About a year ago, the government set up a NGO, I guess, called the Green Finance Institute, GFI, and they have been tasked with how to apply that kind of guiding principle of we've got to get to net zero to financial services. They're not doing everything at once because you've got to pick an order, but actually mortgage finance was the first of the consumer financial products that they looked at. So they put together a big task force. The Building Societies Association was really heavily involved. They got lots of experts to come and sit on a panel, talk about how to do it. And I think housing is a really, really key one because it's, I think, the second or third biggest contributor to carbon emissions in the UK after energy and transport. So our homes and the built environment are critical if we're going to achieve this goal. They have started to release in the last 2 to 3 months green mortgages of varying types. There's lots, there's now I think that's a 6 or 7 available in the market. They all work in slightly different ways. Some of them give you money off your monthly payments if you can demonstrate that you've done some home improvements that bring down your home's carbon footprint. That's sort of basically the premise of it. So the idea is that you are financially rewarded by being more environmentally friendly. Yeah. It was really interesting putting this guide together, actually, because some sectors of personal finance are really on it. So the mortgage guys were like, this is so exciting. Yes, here, have all of this information. We're really on it. And I asked some contacts in the broadband department and they were like, oh my goodness, no one has ever asked us this question before. They literally hadn't thought about it. I did a bit of digging and found that there are in fact two suppliers who base their sort of business models on being green, but I think there's a lot of work there to be done there in terms of savings accounts, current accounts. There's this kind of question about green and ethical exists for those as well. So, for example, the Co-op bank has always been, you know, it's always branded itself the ethical bank.
But backfired slightly with some of the behaviour of some of its senior members of staff a couple of years back, but yes.
Yeah, and I'm not totally sure how stable it is now either. But anyway, that aside, that's ethical, but I don't really know what ethical means. I think it's easier if you do just focus on green. So there is a bank called Triodos. Everything that they do, that's the goal, you know, to be green. And it's possible to get a current account with them. They've got a range of savings accounts. You can get a business account. But you're making a choice if you do that, because what you gain in environmental points, you might be paying for financially. Mm. And there's no green credit cards at the moment. None. That's going to be huge, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, Simon, a point. A lot of people will think... I mean, don't get me wrong, doing great for the environment and all that is brilliant, but it costs a lot of money, doesn't it?
It's a tricky one, that, isn't it? Because you sort of got these two things going on in parallel that make you think, is there any point in doing this? Such as, like, well, it's all very well having a green mortgage, but what's in it for me? Ultimately, most people with a mortgage just go for the cheapest mortgage that is also the one they can get. There's like a Venn diagram of, you know, like, how cheap is it? Can I get it? Will they accept me? How cheap is it? And where it matches in the middle, that's the mortgage they get. And maybe I don't think there's enough people who think about actually where they put their mortgage, because your mortgage is probably, you know, one of your more long-term financial relationships. And maybe if you don't like the big banks, you should go with a smaller building society type thing. But then you speak to a broker and they're like, I should just go with this person because they'll accept you and you'll get that rate. And then they go, oh, okay, yeah, all right, I'll do that. And I'm going to put my hand up here and say that I just did that. Totally didn't mean to. And I did it anyway. You know, with NatWest. I'm like, oh. After the event, I was like, why did I do that? Why didn't I choose like a building society that I think at least tries to do some good for the world? I mean, not to be mean to NatWest, but, you know, RBS and NatWest don't have the greatest recent history.
Alison Rose has just said that she's like, I'm committing to making RBS and NatWest a green bank.
Is that because she found out that I had become a customer?
Possibly.
I think so.
The worst bit is that I had a mortgage with NatWest before. One of my earlier mortgages was with NatWest, and I've then been through Nationwide and First Direct since. But NatWest... I had to pay an early repayment charge. We were 4 years and 9 months or something mad through a 5-year fix. And I had to pay an early repayment charge. And it was, you know, it was well over a grand, because it stepped down a percentage, you know, of their outstanding loan for each year. I reckon we ended up, I don't know what we ended up paying, like well over a grand. And I was always really annoyed that they didn't just waive that. Mm-hmm. I thought that was bang out of order. And then I went and got another mortgage with them about 10 years later. So what were you thinking, you idiot? I can understand why people don't do it. But I guess the advantage of one of these green mortgages, if you're getting something back, if you're getting some money to help improve your home, if you're getting some other kind of incentive, then you can go, okay, yeah, actually, that does work for me. Mm. Maybe I'm paying a little bit extra on the rate. But, you know, maybe that does work for me. Then I think the other thing that's running in parallel with people's desire to just get the cheapest of everything and not think things through properly, just like I did, is the, well, run me through again exactly how my current account can be green.
Yeah.
You're just greenwashing my current account. But my current account, does it have a cost to the environment? Can you do anything to my current account that makes it much greener? My understanding was that I don't get any interest from my current account and you don't make any money from it. So, like, where's the environment going to win in that relationship? Mm. But then you've got to think about it's more the bigger picture. It's more, are you going to hold your key banking relationship with a bank that is out there doing everything it possibly can, you know, to do green stuff and improve the world, or a bank that's doing everything it possibly can to maximize returns for its shareholders? Mm. And whilst your current account may not actually be capable of being green in itself, and may not even make the bank any money, and not really make you any money, overall, the big picture is, you know, that organization is doing something for the good. It's the same with your savings account and things like that as well. And, you know, to go back to my original point, I think we often just don't really apply much thought to this. And there's a chunk of people who are out there doing this, and then there's the rest of us who talk a good game and then do the exact opposite. But I tell you what, if you don't want to talk a good game and then do the exact opposite, I would strongly recommend reading Sarah's guide, because I have never read such a comprehensive guide to all the different kinds of greed finance products that you can take out.
Well done, Sarah. Well done. Thank you, Simon. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into or understand why Simon does what he does. Simon?
You're not going to get that answer.
Well, you don't know.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And shameless plug time, come and play the share game. You could win £500 a week. You could win a £15,000 top prize, £5,000 runners-up prize, £2,000 third spot prize. And you might think, it's a bit late, I'm lagging behind. But our top pick last week was by someone who picked Rolls-Royce and made a stonking great gain of 114%.
Nice.
And that's the kind of thing that if you get lucky in that way, it will send you right up the leaderboard. thisismoney.co.uk/game.
If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.